This is Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, a moral equivalent to the riot. Tonight's guest, Harvey Wheeler, co-author of Failsafe, an expert on crisis situations, just completing a study of violence in American race relations. You speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call's national phone number, area code 212-749-3311. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening, Mr. Wheeler in Santa Barbara.
Yes.
This is Del Shields in New York.
Yes.
Before we get into tonight's subject, I'd like to say a few things about our show, sort of establish the ground rules. What we're trying to do is to set up a communications link between people. For the moment, since our major American crisis is the race crisis, that will be our major emphasis in coming weeks. What we're looking for from our guests and from our callers are ideas, not speeches. And for this reason, we are arbitrarily going to limit our callers to 2 minutes of our air. And if I think somebody is making a speech, I reserve the right to cut them off. Politely, of course, but cut them off. So with that bit of business out of the way, I'd like to turn to our guest in Santa Barbara, California, Harvey Wheeler, and get tonight's program started. Mr. Wheeler wrote a very provocative article in the Saturday Review some weeks back called A Moral Equivalent for Riots. Briefly, it summarized most of the known facts of how we got to this point in American black and white relationships. Agreed, the Kernan Commission's report was right when it said the root cause of race riots in our country was the deep-seated racism that permeates American society and offered some positive solutions for the American black. The most provocative of these ideas included a third federal legislative chamber, a black Congress, to represent black Americans, a new constitutional right to civil disobedience, or a communal program that might include large-scale federal purchase of idle southern farmland and resettling many American blacks who have found no place in the sun of our urban ghettos. Mr. Wheeler, why do you think it might be necessary to have a third black legislative chamber?
Well, the proposal that I made grew out of a section of that article that had dealt with the need for what I called self-strengthening among the people of the poorest areas of our urban ghettos. And the basic problem that was discussed there was the need for developing indigenous, representative, and participational, and democratic, and self-governing institutions among those people. Now, as many of you will know, already in Watts, there has occurred a kind of ghetto organization, a unification movement called the Black Congress, and it has had an extremely salutary and important effect upon the people of the area and in the ability of the people to deal with their problems. Now, it is something like the expansion of that kind of black Congress that I had in mind. And I did not have in mind necessarily a formally organized, constitutionally recognized alternative chamber, although I would not necessarily be against such a chamber if it were broadened beyond the problem merely of ethnic minorities. But what I had in mind was something indeed that is like what is now happening in Resurrection City in Washington, D.C., the convocation of a formally organized and indeed a powerful and omnipresent, that is always present in Washington, lobbying agency representing the problems of the poor at its most powerful and influential way on the centers of power in our nation's capital.
Does this mean that whites are precluded?
No, not at all. I meant to indicate that in the expansion of this idea, the problem would be to find ways of representing and presenting organized representatives and power groups from all kinds of ethnic minorities. But inasmuch as the article dealt primarily with the problems of the Negro ghettos, it concentrated upon what was called a black Congress in that particular case.
Mr. Wheeler, would you explain the correlation that you mentioned in your article between violence and the highly overcrowded living conditions?
Well, there are two problems here. We have a mounting degree of medical evidence, of scientific evidence, that indicates that all children, regardless of color, who are born and raised in conditions of severe cultural deprivation, suffer a virtually irreversible injuries, no matter how affluent their conditions may later become in the rest of their lives. They start life, the race of life, far behind the starting line of those who are born and raised in relatively affluent or at least healthful circumstances. So there is one problem that is extremely severe, and it touches people of all color. It touches simply the poor and the deprived. And that is something that we have to ameliorate as much as we can and as quickly as we can, because obviously a democracy cannot afford to have a major segment of its population biologically deprived from the moment of birth. But beyond that, and even more serious, is what we call sometimes the culture of poverty, or the general problem of cultural deprivation. And this has to do with the way in which the social conditions surrounding the growing up of the child induces in that child what is, as I said previously, a culture of poverty, a vocabulary that is extremely restricted, a view of life that is regressive and downtrodden, a view of possible goals in life that are extremely restricted. And by the time this child reaches school, and again, this has nothing to do with color, but it happens that the majority segment of our poor people are Negroes, and so it strikes selectively against Negroes, although it is a colorblind phenomenon again. So what happens when the poor child from the ghetto reaches school is that the child is herded into the custodial segment of the school. And even though the school may be externally or apparently desegregated, inside it really is segregated, and that school system perpetuates and even accentuates and magnifies the cultural deprivation with which the child started life. And so by the time he ends school, he is thrown out on the streets, or released to the streets to live a life of really insufficient dignity from the standpoint of his worth as a human being. And so it is this problem of cultural deprivation that we certainly must solve, and solve quickly, and we can solve this problem.
Mr. Wheeler, the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders referred to the root of the problem as lying in a deep-seated racism that permeates American society, and I'm reading from your article. What is this deep-seated racism?
Well, I don't know that one can put one's finger on this racism. I think that we all know that it exists, and I think that one of the things I would like to find out from the listeners around the country is what they think about this. Now, here's one thing I would like to suggest, just throw it out as a question. I would like to suggest that every white person in this country is on trial before every member of the ethnic minorities, and especially before members of the Negro race. They're on trial not only collectively as a virtually a ruling group that must justify itself and its culture and must show that it is able to produce justice for all of its people. That trial is something that we always have before us, and we're all always on trial in that sense. But in the relationships between blacks and whites, I have a feeling that there is a version of this trial that is always present. Now, other people can correct me or tell me what is wrong about what I'm saying. But I think that there is such a feeling among blacks that every white man really feels that the black is inferior, that in a condition of interchange, the white man is always put on trial, always being tested to show or to reveal sometime along that he really has this prejudice, that that prejudice is really going to come out, no matter how strong he comes on, no matter what he says, sometime, brother, that's going to come out, and I'm going to show you, and you're on trial. Now, I think that that may be a false generalization, but I think that it happens very often. But I think that there is a sense in which the white man has to somehow go through that cauldron, go through that burning of interrelationships until that kind of residue, wherever that residue may exist, is so burned out of him that the relationships can continue in the future without that trial taking place.
Mr. Wheeler, let's find out what our listeners think. Our telephone number in New York, area code 212-749-3311. I'll repeat the phone numbers again. In New York, area code 212-749-3311. Mr. Wheeler, we'll take our first call from New York City. Listening to Night Call on WLIB-FM is Jim Brown. This is Night Call.
Mr. Wheeler, in response to this, Mr. Wheeler was speaking of, unfortunately, America is a racist country. I mean, let's face it. These are the problems that we're faced with. Americans are violent people. History has proven that they've been violent all through history. And it's a matter of, I don't know, you have to, it's something that we have to live with. And it's true, prejudice is being tested every day. I don't know, I guess the best answer would be association, really. In many cases, people don't really know. They don't know how you are. They don't know your true feelings. I mean, it's easy to look at a person and say and be prejudiced against them. But until you get to really know them, then it's hard to say really. Like I say, to solve the problem in one day or to pass the laws, I don't think it can be done. No matter how many laws you pass or how many bills is passed, that's not going to solve the problem. It really has to begin within our hearts, within each and every American's heart.
Mr. Wheeler?
Yes?
Do you think there's any hope? Jim Brown doesn't seem to think so.
Who is this?
Jim Brown from New York.
Is there any hope? Of course, you know, there has to be hope. It's not a question. We can't afford not to have hope. You know, the caller, I take it, by and large, agrees with the article and with the description of the article that was given and with the comments that I made. Mm-hmm. Now, here's exactly the point. If we look back through history, we know that the odds basically are against us in one sense, because the way in which most peoples in history have solved their minority problems, unfortunately, have been by extermination. And, you know, this is just something that we cannot afford. But let me go on just 1 second. You know, when we're talking about that kind of a problem, we think immediately, yes, the relationship between whites and blacks inside the United States.
Right.
But if we look 30 years into the future and we think about the world and the relationship between the white race and the colored races of the world, who is the minority?
Okay.
And what is that kind of historical solution going to mean then, if it's applied on a world scale?
Right.
So the problem is that, you know, this is not only a question of justice, it is a question of the world itself on trial right now.
Well,
Jim,
to me, it's extremely hard to make a comparison between a world comparison with what's happening within the United States. Now, let's face it,
Jim Brown. We're going to cut away for the station identification, and we're going to ask you to be kind enough to let some of the other folks get on, because we have a number of calls.
Okay, could I make just one last comment?
Yes, you may.
Okay. I was going to mention the fact that the biggest problem that's facing us is the fact that Americans have been extremely cold towards outsiders, period. Okay, we came here, and because our skin is black, we cannot blend in with the white population. We sticks out. Therefore, that present us, we have a special problem here in the United States.
No doubt about it.
Unlike the Germans and the Italians and all, like, they come here and they can blend in.
Okay, Jim. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Harvey Wheeler after station identification. Call it a social pressure valve, the voice of the ghetto, the voice of disgust, the voice of hope. Call it what you will, it's the voice of the people. Night Call lets people talk, and experts on the phone everywhere in the country or world offer answers to some of the problems. Having a heart-to-heart squawk. At least it gets people talking, first about their problems, and eventually to each other. Night Call has a potential cast of 200 million Americans. We now cover 30 stations in 27 cities and Washington, D.C. It could just be the most important listening post on the air today because it starts people talking. A program you should listen to, a forum to speak for yourself. If we don't start talking to each other, we'll end up shouting, and there's no telling where we'll wind up after that. Night Call, every weeknight on this station. This is Night Call. Speak for yourself by calling 212-749-3311. Our subject tonight, a moral equivalent to the riot. Our guest, Harvey Wheeler. Our host, Del Shields.
This is Del Shields in New York, and our guest is Harvey Wheeler in Santa Barbara, California. We have another call from New York or from radio station WLIB, Mr. Wheeler, so we'll take that call. Mr. Cheek. This is Night Call.
Cheek, New York. First of all, I'd like to agree with you that white America and actually the whole white way of life is on trial. And I would like to disagree with you on the point of they do not have to prove anything to black America. They do have to prove something because there is a generation of black youth, especially, and white youth also, that are aware of the conditions in the past, and they see that things are at such a state that they have to either do something about it or at least try to awaken the masses.
I'm sorry, I must have made my made myself clear. I said we had to prove it. I agree with you thoroughly.
Oh, I'm
sorry. I must have said something wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, I thought
I said we are on trial, and we do have to prove and justify ourselves to not only our own people, but to the world.
Mm-hmm. That's all I want. I just wanted to make that comment.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir. Our next call is from Loveland, Colorado, from W.H. Green, who is listening to Night Call on KLOV. This is Night Call.
Good evening. I have a question here with respect to helping people resettle in areas where they could get good jobs. Now, in some of the outlying areas, this is one of them, there are good jobs available for people in less chance situations. And the question I have is how do you get people to take the chance and resettle in some of these areas and take advantage of the opportunities that are there, jobs, housing, and so forth?
Well, it sounds like a bonanza to me. In other words, if you can make the statement that there are jobs in Colorado, and if you can say anything about where they are and what kind, I have a prediction that there's going to be an inundation.
Well,
I think that sounds very encouraging. I don't think it's that hard to get people to move. As a matter of fact, the Negro population is an essentially migrant population. And one of the things that has happened in our urban ghettos is that the influx of Negroes and these migratory waves have been a deculturizing and an unsettling element.
Is there a racial problem in Colorado?
Yes, in some areas I think there's a minor one, but in general, my opinion is that there's no serious problem, and that people are accepted for what they are and what they can do, and not because of the color of their skin or their ethnic background. But we have information about people contacting both the Urban League in Washington and in Denver, and suggesting that some of these people who have skills and who would like to move out be resettled, and so far nothing has happened.
What kind of jobs are you speaking of?
Well, the Colorado Employment Service here, which is a state organization, has made the statement that anybody who really wants to work can be located in a job. It might take a little while, but and that,
well, the main question that we'd ask is whether or not you're speaking basically of personal service jobs.
No, sir. No. No. If you're talking about housemaids and so forth, no.
No.
Rough carpenters.
Well, I think this is good news throughout the country. I am sure it's, your name is being jotted down.
Well, I think it may be true in a lot of places, but we'd certainly be interested in hearing from people who are looking for opportunity to show what they can do.
So the thing to do is to write to the Colorado Employment Service. Is that the idea?
I would say so, in Denver.
Good.
Did you say, sir, that contact had been made with the Urban League and other agencies, and there had been no results?
With the Urban League in both Washington and Denver.
Right. Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a listener from Seattle, Washington, KVOW, Mr. Barrow.
Yes, I'm Dr. Darrow. I'm a psychiatrist, and that's my bias, I guess. I objected to Mr. Wheeler's article in the Saturday Review on several counts. In the first place, I felt that he indicated that his Black Congress, with a capital C, would by no means function as a lobbying body, but as a formal constitutional body, as opposed to what he maintained on this evening's program. I regard Mr. Wheeler as a fatalist, kind of determinist, who seems to feel that a background of poverty is irreversible. Now, my profession of psychiatry is based on the opposite. I feel that individuals possess sufficient assets to rise above their backgrounds. With help, of course. Mr. Wheeler does not mention in his article in the Saturday Review the importance of self-control, of using legal means within constitutional frameworks to exert pressure towards changing situations. I feel that people who downgrade the Negro's individual abilities and maintain that he needs special legislation, such as what Mr. Wheeler calls a constitutional right to civil disobedience, unquote, these people are themselves racist. In the psychiatric scheme, racial prejudice is a mixture of fear and guilt, and I think that it should be attacked on a more fundamental level, and I suggest caution in using the Negro to assuage our own white guilt. I think that by doing so, we'll ultimately do him a disservice.
Good. May I respond?
Fine.
In the first place, on the Black Congress, I think that a rereading of that section will show that the issue is left undefined in the article. And what I'm mainly talking about is the need for building community corporations and participational institutions throughout the ghetto, regardless, basically, of color, but
yes.
Obviously concentrating upon color because that's what it lives in the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
And through the development of these organizations, such as the ECHO Community Corporation experiment that is being maintained by Kotler,
uh-huh,
in Columbus, to be able to send representative groups in a kind of pyramiding way to a central Washington institution. Now, I would not be against this being formalized legally. I am,
uh-huh,
not against it, but it wouldn't have to be. And the comments that I made earlier this evening on the air are in line with what I think is not only possible, but I think it's probable that something,
right,
like that, as a permanent, more or less informal Black Congress, will become institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
Now, secondly, with regard to being fatalist, I certainly am not, on the contrary, and thinking that these things are irreversible.
I do believe that the medical evidence is irrefutable, that there are certain kinds of biological deprivation early in childhood that produce irreversible effects. And I don't think that we need argue about it if it's a question of difference on facts. It's just a difference on facts, and any argument will go get nowhere, because I happen to believe that the evidence on that is fairly persuasive. However, the main part of the article on cultural deprivation dealt with what I thought, and I agree with you, are reversible effects of cultural deprivation, and the entire thrust of the latter part of the article was to try to suggest programs that would reverse and would indeed not be fatalist, as I believe that we probably are officially in our policies now, applying fatalist policies. Now, with regard to your issue, your point about self-control and the exercise of legal pressures, and that comes into the final point that refers to civil disobedience.
Right.
I believe that, in general, we, all of us in this country, are at the brink of a new step in the development of democratic practices and the development of the history of democracy. And I believe that what we are being shown by our students, by our youth, by our black people, by our brown beret Mexican-Americans, and by all of the protesting groups throughout the country, what we are being shown is that the traditional institutions of democracy are no longer serving the aims and the goals for which they were designed. And there's a very good reason for that. We produced these institutions when we were an agrarian country, and we speak today still using phrases like grassroots democracy. And they were indeed institutions that were adjusted and were relevant to the conditions of a country that was pre-industrial, basically, pre-urban. Now we are an urban country, and no country, even in history, has produced what might be called a participatory, really acting and effective democratic institutions for an urban environment. Now, this is the challenge, it seems to me, that faces all of us today, and it is the challenge that I believe the black people are taking up and perhaps helping us find solutions to. Solutions that will be rough-hewn and have some edges that will rub us wrong and will have to be polished and developed, as indeed were the earlier institutions of democracy, with the Shays Rebellion and many of the other things that happened in the preliminary stages of the development of grassroots democracy. These also will have some of their rough edges that will have to be honed down and developed. But the point remains that a new doctrine of civil disobedience as a way into the problem of pioneering the institutions of urban democracy for the future, urban or what you might call curbstone democracy, that's the challenge of our time, and that, it seems to me, is one of the necessities that the black revolution is dealing with.
I
think we disagree all down the line.
I think we do, but I think perhaps on some level we do agree, and I think that our main disagreement is about the methods that will be used to gain an end which we both wish, and this doctrine of constitutional disobedience is one that is sort of repugnant to me.
Yeah, it's a little strange at first.
Yes, yes, and I just don't feel that will be necessary, though.
Gentlemen, we're going to break for station identification, and if you'll hold on the line, we'll come right back. This is the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Harvey Wheeler after station identification. In our city and state, and all across the United States, people are talking about trouble, black and white trouble. Some call it racial tension, or see poverty as the real problem, or say law and order has given way to anarchy in our streets. Most people agree, at least, that there is a crisis, and we are a people with many unanswered questions. This station believes you deserve to ask your own questions and get some answers, or at least opinions, from people who should know what they're talking about. So we bring you Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show where you ask your questions and express your opinions to leaders such as John Lindsay, Ralph Abernathy, John Gardner, Stokely Carmichael, and Sergeant Shriver. Night Call, the new nationwide radio forum on important issues facing you and the rest of the nation. Night Call, each weeknight. This is Night Call. Speak for yourself by calling 212-749-3311. Our subject tonight, a moral equivalent to the riot. Our guest, Harvey Wheeler. Our host, Del Shields.
This is Del Shields in New York, and our guest in Santa Barbara is Mr. Harvey Wheeler. We had on the phone Dr. Darrow from Seattle, Washington. And, Doctor, if you'll be kind enough, we're going to move on to some additional listeners. We thank you very much for calling.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We're going to take a call from Brooklyn, New York, from Mrs. Mercedes, who is calling from radio station WLIB. This is Night Call. Hello?
Hello?
Mrs. Mercedes?
Yeah, you got me all confused.
Well, we didn't mean to confuse you, but now you're on the air.
Mm-hmm.
What is your question?
I didn't have a question, though. I got all confused of what the explanation that guy gave, Del Shields.
Well, this is Night Call. If you have a question for Mr. Wheeler, he'll be more than happy to answer for you.
No, I'm sorry.
All right, thank you for calling. We'll take our next call from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Mrs. Graves from radio station WAMO. This is Night Call.
Hello?
Mrs. Graves?
Yes?
Welcome to Night Call.
Thank you. Mr. Wheeler?
Yes?
I would like to know, why do you think that Congress is so slow about taking action upon this poverty program for the poor? I mean, when that the people that they are still sending care packages overseas, and there is so many here that are dying from starvation. And when there is a, this is supposed to be one of the richest countries, as they say, why couldn't they give a little bit of consideration to the poor here without prolonging the issue so much?
Well, Mrs. Graves, I'm afraid that the sad fact about the operation of the domestic political system in America is that it is like a big piece of heavy machinery that has many different parts and many different kinds of wheels, and it only moves the way it's pushed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is to organize the pressures, and this is the way in which our tradition of democracy has always worked in the past. The people who have wanted the things and have organized to get them and have been able to focus sufficient power on the centers of legislation have been able to get the results out the other end. And it has happened in the past that the poor people have not been politically organized.
Right.
And I believe that there are signs that that a change is taking place. And there is certainly a need for that change, and with the developing political organization, the intensification of the pressures, and the insistent demands by people for their just rights, I think that there's possibility of some hope. But I think that it also is true that it depends upon us. In other words,
yes,
we do have to organize. We cannot just sit.
That's true.
There is no way to just sit and hope that Congress will do something.
That's
because
right.
Congress isn't built that way.
No.
Mr. Wheeler?
It's built to respond to pressures.
Mr. Wheeler, do you think that Resurrection City is a positive step?
Well, you know, I just hope and pray that it doesn't fail. I mean, if it wins, it's certainly a positive. One of the greatest positive steps we've made. It just has to. We all have to support it, and we all have to help it win. But Resurrection City certainly has the potential for being one of the landmarks in American political history. Now, there's just no doubt about that.
Do you think that something will materialize from this?
If Resurrection City survives, a whole lot will materialize from it.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next call will be coming from New York, Mr. Wheeler, from radio station WRVR. And we have Mr. Barrett. This is Night Call.
Yes, I have a comment I'd like to make with regard to this discussion. I'd like to know, do you feel that forcing integration between people who do not want to integrate. Do you think that this is a good thing for racial tension?
No, I personally do not. And I personally feel that the real deep need in the poverty-stricken areas of the country is not necessarily for integration. Now, I believe that integration should be possible, that it should not be restricted, it should not be foreclosed, and I believe that all of us should move as quickly as we can to an open society, a democratically open society in which we all accept each other as far as possible, as far as we possibly can, as equals. But I don't believe that at this moment the real needs in the ghetto areas will be served by busing or forcibly exporting in some way or another people outside. I think that the real needs will be met by building indigenous, self-supporting, representative and democratic and participational community organizations within the poverty areas. And that is the thing that I believe that we must all try to facilitate.
Mm-hmm. Would you go then for the standard income for everybody that the Congress is passing through? Or
well, the guaranteed annual income, the GAI.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, am I against it? No, I'm not against it, but I think that it will probably be passed in one form or another. It'll be called a negative income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it will be passed for the wrong reason and probably administered in the wrong way. I think that Congress might get stampeded into doing a kind of token job on this and passing a bill providing for a minimum guaranteed annual income with what they think is a kind of a riot insurance provision that they can buy off riots if they do it. And to that extent, they're both wrong, and the motives are wrong, and it's bound to be wrong in its administration.
In other words, you feel it's a reward for rioting.
Well, I don't say that it's a reward for rioting, but I believe that the motives that congressmen will probably, if they pass it, will probably regard it as riot protection insurance. Now, I think that, you know, everything is wrong about that. But I'm not against the program, you understand. I think that guaranteed annual incomes are going to come, and I think that the leisured automated society is going to require them, and all people will have a different kind of view toward their relationship between income and work from the one that we've had in the past. But that's the long-run picture within which this thing has to be understood. But the basic point is that if the program is passed as a form of riot insurance with that motive, all it will do will be to exacerbate the problem. It will not solve it. It will probably make the psychological condition of the recipient worse, and nothing could be farther from the needed approach to the problem.
Mr. Wheeler,
In general, I am in favor and regard as inevitable guaranteed annual income.
Mr. Wheeler, yes. You view rioting as an American way of life.
Yes, an American way of life in a strange sense. That is, every group that has come to this country, every ethnic minority, starting with the first ones, has had to carve out their own special way of building for themselves the right to possess and enjoy the values of American culture. And the various groups that came did it in various ways. The first groups were able to go into to propriety, to the proper business channels, the professions. The second groups came along and those were foreclosed, and they had to move into and organize political parties. And some groups, even as some suggestions have been made, some groups that came even organized crime as a way of participating in American the bounties of American life. Now, the only thing that I'd say about that is that now, for the poor, for the Negro, almost every avenue to participation in the good things of the American way of life is foreclosed. And the only real one that remains is direct organization of power in a political sense. And this means power in the streets, participational power. And so I don't say rioting as an American way of life, but civil disobedience, direct action, the new forms of democracy. These will be the avenues through which the poor people and the deprived and those discriminated against in various ways find their way of influencing the American political process and participating in the American dream.
Do you feel, sir, that this guaranteed annual income would discourage able-bodied Americans from going out and working?
You were back on the income. Listen, I'm for the guaranteed annual income. I just think there's certain destructive aspects about the way it'll probably come about. And I don't think that money has ever kept people from working. If a man is not going to work, it's not going to be affected by whether or not he's rich. Most rich people, work 18 hours a day. Some of them don't. If you gave them more and more money, they'd still work that much. The acquisition of money usually stimulates people to want more. That's been the basis of the American experience, the American miracle.
Mr. Wheeler, we're going to move on to take some more calls, and thank you very much, sir, for calling.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. Our next call comes from St. Paul, Minnesota, radio station KJSN. This is Night Call.
Yes. Before I make my comment, may I ask you, are you on a delay?
Are we on a delay?
Yes.
Yes, we are.
I see. And I also wanted to know, is your guest on right now? Is he saying he's for integration or is he for segregation?
Mr. Wheeler?
I didn't understand the question.
Are you for integration or segregation?
You see, I think that the problem has almost moved beyond that way of stating it.
I see. Yes.
I am for integration, but I believe that a long struggle is going to be in front of us before can come back to integration on honest terms.
Are you a Negro?
What?
Are you a Negro?
Why? Why should I answer that?
No, I was just asking because I happen to be white, and I know right now that the school I go to is not integrated, but there are schools that I have those people going, and I think it's going to do a lot of good health. I mean, I've got my...
Well, I do, too. I'm not against integration. I'm just saying that when we started out, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, We got this law, this ruling from the Supreme Court, and we all felt that integration was going to be the answer, and we were going to be able to work it out, and it was going to come gradually but relatively quickly, and everything would be okay. And now, lo, these many, many years later, we find out that the problem is really much more serious than that.
It
looks like we're going to have to circle back on ourselves in a little bit before we can move forward.
One final comment. As I say, I am a white person, but I think for people of my race to get to know more Negro people would be just wonderful. I think if both races can work together and if both can understand each other, this world is going to be really wonderful.
I do, too. I agree with you, and I'm not against integration. Don't misunderstand me. I just believe that the strengthening of people and their self-respect is a precondition to their being equals together.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Mr. Wheeler, we'll be right back after we pause for station identification. This is the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Harvey Wheeler after station identification. Black is a red-blooded American color. The black showed the color of his blood in places like Vietnam and Korea and every other all-American battleground since the Revolution. Every time his country calls for help, he hears. But we don't seem to hear him when he calls. If black and white would listen with their hearts, they could hear each other. That's what Night Call is all about. It lets people air their views man to man, color to color, live from phones anywhere in the country. A syringe full of junk bites into black and white skin with the same ruining surge, and a black mother cries over her child just like a white one does. The problems are the same. The characters just have different colors. Night Call's person-to-person nationwide radio hookup lets the black and the white tell it like it is. This is Night Call. Speak for yourself by calling 212-749-3311. Our subject tonight, a moral equivalent to the riot. Our guest, Harvey Wheeler. Our host, Del Shields.
This is Del Shields in New York, and our guest tonight is Harvey Wheeler from Santa Barbara, California. Mr. Wheeler, would you elaborate for a moment on the statement you wrote in the article that revolutions are made by rising classes rather than by declining classes, and why?
Well, this is an observed pattern in the history of revolutions, and that is that people at the most depressed level of society are just too depressed. They are sometimes engaging in what are called revolutions of the belly, but they're quickly suppressed and put down, and no results occur except murder. But revolutions occur when people have experienced a slight increase in their condition and their expectations rise, and then they are frustrated in some sense. And it's in the reaction of that frustration historically, that relatively rising and relatively well-to-do peoples from the bottom levels, obviously, but relatively rising, begin to demand the right to the vistas that they see opening before them. And that's what the statistical evidence of the cities that have had riots have shown. The riots have been made not by the very poorest and most depressed and most deprived people in the ghettos, but people basically who have had a little bit and who hope for a lot more.
Well, do you feel that the riots by black people strengthen and build their own self-respect in any way?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. The evidence is overwhelming that there's been what sometimes sociologists call a re-emasculation of the Negro male in the riot process. In fact, there's a curious thing about the Detroit riot, and it was a virtual, literal re-emasculation process in the sense that during the riots, the Planned Parenthood centers were swamped with demands by Negro women who were faced with excessive demands by their men. But it's more than that. That's just a light reflection episode. The thing is the self-respect that all over Watts, for example, people created their own self-respect. I could read, I don't want to take too much time, but I could read one paragraph by Eldridge Cleaver on the difference that people felt about Watts the day after the riots. Before the riots, it was a sin to be from Watts, and you never admitted it. And it was like being a hayseed, you know, lamey. Nothing was farther from something that you would admit. After the riots occurred, everybody in California was from Watts. You know, man, this is the brothers down there doing, you know, and the riots made pride.
Let's invite some additional comments from our listeners. Our telephone number in New York, area code 212-749-3311. The telephone numbers again, area code 212-749-3311. We have a call from Omaha, Nebraska, from radio station KBON, Mr. Taylor.
Yes.
Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask you, Mr. Wheeler, you mentioned that if this negative income tax were adopted as a sort of riot insurance or something, that this would have a bad effect. Could you explain how the effect would be bad? Why would it be bad?
Well, suppose you and I pass a negative income tax with the motive that we're going to buy off the riots. And so what we do is distribute money through the ghetto area. And when we distribute money through the ghetto area, what we do is to increase the momentum of the revolution of rising expectations. and yet we have not provided a creative human personality building aspect to go along with that. We have added to the fuel in the sense of allowing people to look forward to having more and more good things, but we have not added to the essential human self-respect and dignity that must come as a basic solution to the problem.
How would you add to that self-respect and dignity? What sort of program?
Well, I can only hope that maybe you might get a hold of that article in the Saturday Review, but I have, and early in the program at the beginning it was summarized, but I have tried to enumerate several different avenues through which this could be attacked. One of them is through the building of community corporations and community organization. Another one is through a general self-strengthening kind of process in which even leaders of black communities might be sent abroad to study the problems of the developing countries, the most effective of the developing countries, drastic reforms in the educational system, and several things such as that.
Thank you so much, sir.
It's been very interesting. I wonder if I could talk to your director again as I go off the air.
Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a call from Jacksonville, Florida, Mr. Ken Knight at radio station WRHC. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Mr. Wheeler, please.
He's on the air, sir.
Mr. Wheeler, in as much as the black people, and I think your book dealt primarily with them and the riots in the street, I wanted to ask one question. Would you suggest that, well, I'd like to preface this question before I ask it. I think the majority of the Negroes in America does not want handouts. They want equal opportunities and jobs. Would you suggest in your book or in your suggestions that a Negro be given an equal opportunity and job training so that he could be integrated into the slipstream of the American industry and earn rather than be given handouts?
Yes, sir. That's a basic part of the recommendation that is made with regard to education. However, it is not made in terms of equal opportunity to jobs specifically, but rather equal opportunity to the educational possibility of developing himself to his highest possible potential. And then if that occurs, the well-developed human being will be able to find and adjust himself to varying job situations as those job situations occur. See, the problem with the line of thought that I think was in your mind is that we bring in people that are functionally illiterate and we stimulate them to go into a technical job training program with the promise that when they get out of it, there'll be a job. And so it's a big barrier, but we finally get them motivated. They go through the training. By the time they get out, the job has been automated out of existence. And we can't stimulate them again. They said, no, I've been down that road one time too many already. At somebody else's bag, I'm through. I've had it. And so the technical kind of training, I'm afraid, is not the answer. But the general human development of the human personality, starting in the school process, that seems to me to be the only true solution.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. Our number's in New York, area code 212-749-3311. We have a call from Omaha, Nebraska, and radio station KBON, Army or Air Force Sergeant, pardon me, Randolph. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Yes. I think the interviewer here, yeah, I think he's missed the point or missed the vote. I think the Negroes, unless they gain dignity among other American society, that they will become more dangerous, not less passive, but the more education and job opportunities, the more power they get, they will become more dangerous, not less dangerous. And we see this every day. It's not housing, it's not jobs. I mean, these are just stepping stones. The ultimate thing in the society is dignity among men, respect. I mean, you can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have respect from your neighbor or the man you work for, or even maybe a person who works for you. I mean, this is the ultimate goal, I think, of the Negro. And these other things are just eyewashes, boy, as I can see it.
Well, I think that we can all agree that all of us want, each one of us wants dignity and respect, and there's no doubt about that. Now, the other thing about it is, though, that each one of us wants, if at all possible, the ability to earn a living, a decent living, and to participate in what seems to be the ideals of a just society, what we would all agree would be the ideals of a just society. And America has had that dream for many years, and I think that we all believe in extending the potentiality of participating in that dream to everyone. So I would agree with you halfway, I guess, on the question of dignity, but not on the question of some of the other things that you said.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a call from New York, Mr. Patton of radio station WLIB. Welcome to Night Call, sir. Thank you for being patient.
Thank you. Mr. Wheeler, I've been listening to you for quite a while now, and I believe that you're a man that's seeking, you know, to get the truth out. And I want to ask you this question. I hope it's not barred from the air. But I want to know if you can give me what you consider your definition of a bastard child is. And this is going to lead to something further. But I must get his definition from you first.
Well, that's something that I'm not prepared to define. I don't know. What does that mean?
Well, what I was trying to establish was this. I heard you say a while ago that you were for integration. You weren't against integration.
Yeah.
Well, now, this, to me, is said to be an unwritten law, but as far as I'm concerned, it's practiced and it's used, and it may as well be a written law. Now, you know yourself, if a black man marries a white woman, his heritage, the child's heritage, reverts back to the father. The child becomes a black child. Now, if a white man marries a black woman, the heritage of the child does not revert back to the father. The child becomes a Negro child. It reverts back to the mother. Now, this is my conception of a real bastard child. He is not accepted by the father. He does not get the father's heritage. So maybe this is a statement, or maybe this is a fact why people say the only two free people in the world are a white man and a black woman. She can have a child by a white man, but still a child will be considered a Negro, and she won't be considered as having a child out of her race.
Mr.
The
Patton?
White man can have this pleasure and
Mr.
not
Patton.
Be hung with the responsibility.
We only have a little bit of time left, and we're going to ask Mr. Beale if he'll comment on that, and we thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Well, I'm afraid that this is just a little bit out of the area.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wheeler. We're going to have to cut you.
I think it's a terribly...
Mr. Wheeler, we thank you.
Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station. The president of the Baltimore Urban Coalition, former Governor Theodore Roosevelt McKeldin of Maryland, on what his organization is trying to do to keep his city from falling apart. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with the National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, and National Urban Coalition.